This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
He is the man of our country and a man who our country really needs and needs badly to ensure the rule of law and the rule of justice.
With a bit of glitz and full network primetime coverage and a greatly anticipated announcement, President Donald Trump displayed his mastery of the television presidency and his own signature pageantry in announcing 49-year-old federal appeals court judge Neil Gorsuch as his nominee to the U.S. Supreme Court Tuesday night. With his wife standing close by, a proud Gorsuch was a polished winner of a guessing contest that had gone on for weeks in Washington, D.C. and elsewhere.
I pledge that if I am confirmed, I will do all my powers permit to be a faithful servant of the Constitution and laws of this great country.
If confirmed, Justice Gorsuch would restore the 4-4 conservative-liberal split in the court with Justice Anthony Kennedy, the mystery man swing vote. But Democrats retained some bitterness after Republicans refused to even set hearings for President Obama's nominee, Merrick Garland. Scalia died, you'll recall, last February, nearly a year ago. They may put up a tough fight for Gorsuch just to save face, which confuses matters for all of us regular old American citizens wondering if the court is capable of shielding itself from politics anymore. Eric Citrin, partner at Goldstein & Russell, former clerk to Justices O'Connor and Kagan, is a guest contributor to the SCOTUS blog. Welcome, Eric.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
First of all, Neil Gorsuch has an absolutely, you know, supreme record, superlative reputation as a legal scholar. How do you assess him?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. He is, in many senses, a very conventional nominee for the Supreme Court in the sense of being a supremely qualified and very well thought of judge who has sterling academic and legal credentials. He was a Harvard Law School graduate, a scholar at Oxford, a senior official in the Bush administration, and is recognized as one of the very best writers on the federal bench, and someone who takes hearing the cases and the craft of being a judge extremely seriously. And so just from the standpoint of raw qualification, he is sort of obviously qualified. Exactly in the sense that, you know, someone like Merrick Garland was hugely qualified for the bench and not really debatable on that point.
How do you think Gorsuch fancies himself in a role on the court? Do you think he likes the idea of being the Scalia guy, or do you think he more wants to be a little bit of a cipher where he might actually take over the role of Anthony Kennedy and be a bit of a mystery, surprise people who have appointed him, that sort of thing?
It's very hard to say. In many respects, Judge Gorsuch is a very, very natural and close successor of Justice Scalia. Many of his judicial ideological commitments are very similar to textualism and originalism, an overwhelming conservative bent in general. Those things indicate that you could see him falling into the Scalia role. But I did just say he has one very different style point, which is that Justice Scalia loved to fight. You know, he would take the liberal clerks from other justices out for lunch and just, you know, say the most provocative thing he could to try to get everyone's blood up and have a fun conversation that way. Judge Gorsuch has the opposite instinct. I think it's much more conciliatory and respectful. And you could see that actually leading him to try to moderate views about some things in order to pick up other justices, to be more of a kind of a bridge builder. But he is very committed to his judicial philosophy points, and I think that that will make him more like Scalia and less like Kennedy in the sense of being somewhat predictable. You know, if a case pushes textualist buttons, you can just expect Judge Gorsuch to follow the text. If you're trying to, you know, enforce an unwritten aspect of constitutional law that doesn't have a strong basis in the Constitution, it's going to be really hard to convince him to do so. And he doesn't have the pragmatic instincts of a Justice Kennedy or a Justice Breyer on the other side, for example.
So imagining specific issues, is he likely to be strong on states' rights, which were many of the cases that related to Obamacare and some of the other cases that came before the court over the last 8 years? Is he going to be strong on issues that would relate to voting rights, for instance? Would he support a further change in the Voting Rights Act, et cetera?
It's very hard to say. I would say, you know, Justice Scalia And many other conservative justices have a strong commitment to the limited powers of the federal government under the Constitution. And I could see Judge Gorsuch following that model as well. You know, I would expect him to think that the powers of the federal government are textually limited because that's clear from the document. You know, the fight at the margins about how far they extend can be very different and personal as between different judges.
What about the EPA? Do you think the EPA is a special case? Do you think he views the EPA as an overreach?
Well, I don't think it's possible to think that, like, environmental protection in general is an overreach. There are some aspects of environmental protection jurisdiction where Justice Scalia and I think many other conservative justices think, look, this is just not an interstate issue. It's just a local issue. It's not really an appropriate thing for federal government intervention on. Judge Gorsuch also, unlike Justice Scalia, is somewhat skeptical of deference to the administrative state. That can mean that he would be more willing to push back on what EPA is doing, although Justice Scalia had been famously pushing back on a lot of EPA stuff under Obama.
There's also the fact that he's from the West. I mean, that may relate as well.
That's right. And what I would say is I think most likely what you'll see is that he will not be rolling over for an administration one way or the other. I would think more than anything else, he'll think of himself as a rule of law judge. And that can be a very good thing either way.
Eric Citron is a partner at Goldstein & Russell, former clerk to Justices O'Connor and Kagan, and a guest contributor to SCOTUS blog. Thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
We turn now to someone who knows Justice Gorsuch. Jamil Jaffer clerked for him. He's a director of the Homeland and National Security Law Program at the Scalia Law School of George Mason University, and he's a visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution. A big day for Neil Gorsuch. Do you think he faces an uphill battle, that he is up to the task of winning over those folks who are going to be probably pretty bitter over the fact that Obama's pick wasn't subject to confirmation? And, you know, this is a political fight before we even get started on legal theory.
Sure. Look, you know, I think you're absolutely right to say that, you know, there's a lot of people upset about the whole Merrick Garland situation. But here's the thing about Neil Gorsuch. He is a very smart guy, but also a kind and caring man. And I think that will come across, you know, to the senators, the folks he talks to. He's very genuine. You know, he's the kind of guy that you want to have a beer with, you know, go fly fishing with, and which is something he does. And so I think he's going to be able to convince a lot of people that, you know, he's not an extreme judge. To the contrary, he's a conservative judge, to be sure, but in the mainstream of conservatives. And that's all right, because you're going to get a conservative judge from Donald Trump. And so you ought to give him an up or down vote. And, you know, vote your conscience. But, you know, Neil Gorsuch, he's a smart guy. He deserves a job.
Where does he stand, or where is he likely to stand on some of the big issues before the court that, you know, get so much play at these confirmation hearings? Roe v. Wade, states' rights, I guess environmental law. And the role of the EPA now is a big one. Where do you think he's going to go as far as that's concerned?
You know, Neil Gorsuch is not the kind of guy who looks at the outcome of the case and says, I got to get to this result, right? To the contrary, what he does is he looks at the law and says, what has Congress done here? What has the executive branch done here? What is the people who the Constitution assigns the role of signing these laws, what have they done? And if it's the Constitution, what do the framers do here? And so he's not looking for a policy result. In fact, as he said last night, you know, a judge who likes the outcome in every case he decides is probably not a very good judge, and he actually means that. So if you look at his opinions, there are a lot of cases where he's had a very liberal, quote-unquote, liberal outcome. There are cases where he's had a very, quote-unquote, conservative outcome, because it's not about the outcome for him. It's about getting the law right.
The court has said to Congress in a lot of decisions and even in some dissents, Congress needs to do more of its job. It needs to make law as opposed to coming to the court, or the country coming to the court to decide things that Congress is too politically averse to actually taking up. What do you think Neil Gorsuch thinks about that?
I think that it's critically important that Congress does its job, that it not over-delegate to the executive branch, and that it not leave the decision to the courts. You know, all too often today, you know, people want to get their policy preferences into the law through the courts, and that's not the way to do it. It's not the way our framers envision it. They envision a system by which you go to your elected officials in Congress, in the House and the Senate, and you talk to the president, you vote with your feet, and you vote with your vote. not you vote with your, you know, pen in the litigation. And so, you know, we got to get judges out of the job of being politicians and let them just be judges. And when that cuts all the more true for justice of the Supreme Court. And I think that's, you know, if I were a predictor, I think that's how Justice Gorsuch, if he was confirmed, would think about these issues.
Jamil Jaffer was a clerk for Neil Gorsuch. He's director of the Homeland and National Security Law Program at the Scalia Law School of George Mason University. So, of course, this week we've experienced the protests, the legal arguments, and the Democratic and even some Republican pushback from the Trump 7-Muslim-majority country executive order immigration ban. Do we feel safer from terrorism? That's the real question. A poll by Reuters out yesterday found that 49% of Americans either strongly or somewhat agree with Trump's order, while 41% strongly or somewhat disagreed. Norm Kreider is a United States Marine who says to him, this ban makes a lot of sense.
I think the nation as a whole probably is safer if we limit the amount of people coming into this country that we can't properly vet.
What is your definition of vetting?
My definition of vetting is that we need to fully understand who someone is, why they're coming here, what their background is, what their connections are. And there seems to be a lot of confusion about that. People have entered the country before under false premise and then committed acts or attempted to. And, you know, we do a good job most of the time rooting that out. But it only takes one. You know, it's the old adage where we have to be right all the time. And a terrorist only has to be right once.
And, of course, that wouldn't have helped us with Timothy McVeigh or the fellow at Fort Hood.
Well, no, not necessarily. You're always going to have a certain amount of homegrown terrorism. You're going to have people here that are unhappy and do crazy, awful, horrible things. It's just a part of life. But, you know, the government's job is to protect us from foreign entities or foreigners or anyone coming into the country. That's just a matter of national security. That's the job. It's not like it's an unprecedented thing to have a ban on travel from certain countries in the world. The last six presidents have done it.
In the case of Obama, the report was they were dealing with a very specific threat on the making of IEDs from Iraqis and looking at fingerprint evidence. And so they shut down Iraqis coming into the country for a period of weeks.
Well, right. Well, the President Obama ban in 2011 was actually 6 months. And it was because two al-Qaeda members had came through the process and it hadn't been detected and it had taken up residence in Kentucky and were attempting to commit acts of terror. So yeah, there's always a chance someone can get through. It's, you know, you just need to know who's coming. And it seems to me, you know, I question why people from a culture that's very different than the normal culture of America want to come halfway around the world when they could maybe seek asylum in a country more close to their home, more culturally in tune with who they are. I just, you know, I question why they come here. I think we need to question why America? Why do they want to come here?
You use the word normal culture of America. What do you mean by that?
Well, the normal cultures of America, Muslims do not make up a very large percentage of this country. It's a very, very small minority of people who believe in Islam.
Fastest growing religion in the U.S.
It is, and a lot of that is because we've opened the door and we're allowing thousands and thousands of people to come here that believe this religion. And this religion has proven, you know, if you study it, if you read the Quran, if you listen to some of their clerics talk, it has some touches of violence in it, some extreme violence, and we just need to be aware of that.
So if you see Muslims in the United States, are you suspicious of them? Are you worried about them?
I'm not worried about them, but I definitely, you know, understand what they believe. It's not that I walk around in fear of Muslims. I'm not afraid of Islam. You know, Muslim is a choice. You know, it's like any religion. You know, it where you can choose it or you can walk away from it.
Do you understand how some people might hear what you're saying and feel like that's, you know, just sort of broadly intolerant of, you know, a billion people in the world?
I can understand that. But at the same time, I'm not concerned with a billion people in the world. I'm concerned with the safety and security of 310 or 15 million Americans.
You know, let's turn it around. I mean, I think if there are bad people coming to the United States who want to get weapons and shoot Americans, I do not want them here, period.
Right.
The end. But how we do that, you know, is a little bit of a head scratcher when we haven't had any problem with that over the last 10 years. It's like we're, I mean, I don't know if we're necessarily doing a bad job up till now. What do you think?
Well, I think there have been people who have come here, maybe not necessarily as refugees, but we see people who have immigrated here that have committed acts. Or technically, you could say the Zarnoff brothers, the Boston Marathon bombers, they came under an application for asylum, which once that's accepted, then you become a refugee. The shooter in Chattanooga that shot the men at the recruiting station, his family arrived here as refugees from Kuwait. So it's not like there hasn't ever been an actual refugee. They might have been very young when they came here, but they have a certain belief, and it's a common belief. And so we have to strongly vet people that have that belief. I mean, if you want to believe that, that's your choice, but we need to know what you believe, why you believe it, why you want to come here. Are you sinister in your approach? Is it a jihadi trying to sneak in as a refugee? We need to know these things. And I think putting a 120-day or a six-month moratorium on this until we can come up and really believe that we have the best vetting process possible before we open up to, you know, these people. And we're talking about seven countries that seem to be somewhat hostile to America.
Norm, but Kuwait isn't one of them. Chechnya isn't one of them. Saudi Arabia, where the 19 hijackers came from, is not one of these countries. Abu Dhabi, where Donald Trump has hotel interests, is not one of them. I mean,
I I'm with you. I don't know why they didn't broaden that travel ban to some of these other countries where we know terrorists have come from. So I'm with you there. I think personally, I don't think it was a broad enough, you know, ban. I think it should have been a much more large area of that region of the world that we should have looked into this.
Any advice to the president for how he did this, how he put this into action? Very suddenly, Congress has said maybe you should have talked to us about some of the wording of it. Some other folks have said the same thing before we go.
Yeah, I've read the ban, you know, in its entirety, and there are a couple subsections in it that I think could have used a little bit of clarification. I think maybe he should have talked about this and put the information out there and said, we're going to do this in sometime in the next, you know, week or 10 days and kind of let people that had traveled realize this was coming and give them a chance to get home.
Norm Kreider, Marine Corps veteran of what, Desert Storm?
Yes, sir.
A Trump supporter. We're talking to him about his support for the immigration ban that took place this week from the Trump administration. Norm Kreider, thank you so much for talking to us on The Takeaway.
All right. Thank you, John.
After talking with Norm, we wanted to underscore here, no immigrant or even the son or daughter of an immigrant from one of those seven countries has killed anyone in a terrorist attack on U.S. soil for more than 30 years. And if you were thinking of the two San Bernardino shooters and that haunting airport picture of them coming back into the U.S., Syed Rizwan Farooq was born in Illinois, and Tashfeen Malik, his wife, came from Pakistan, which is not on the list. This program, along with our friends at The World and our partner PRI, are taking to Twitter to ask the president some of your questions about the new administration. Since the president loves Twitter so much, we decided to use it. It's a project we're calling 100 Days, 100 Questions. You can follow along using the hashtag on Twitter, 100 Days, 100 Qs. That's 100 Days, 100 Qs. So we're going to review some of the questions we've been asking so far or have been asked to us. Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. Are you ready? It's kind of quiz show time for you.
I'm ready, John. I've done my research.
So we won't go through all the questions, but here's some ones that lots of listeners had for the president. Todd, do we know how Trump came up with his list of nominees for the Supreme Court and what criteria he looked at before deciding to nominate Neil Gorsuch, who we talked about at the beginning of the hour?
Right. And so many people are wondering about that litmus test, right? How did the president choose? He came up with his list during the campaign. Some of that, most of it, let's be honest, was political. The president coming up with a very conservative list of judges because the president needed to impress conservative Americans, evangelical voters, conservative voters who wanted a conservative Supreme Court justice. That's the politics. Now, Trump himself had said that he wanted a conservative in the mold of Antonin Scalia. He mentioned Scalia several times in that rollout last night in the East Room when Neil Gorsuch was getting his introduction in front of Washington dignitaries and television cameras. In fact, Scalia's wife and son were present in the front row for that rollout. So in the campaign close to a year ago, Trump said in terms of policy for a litmus test, John, that he would use that case D.C. versus Heller. as a litmus test. That's the ruling that severely limited the ability of the District of Columbia, or in this case states, to limit gun ownership, in this case handguns. They basically said self-defense in the home, you have to be able to own a handgun in the home. D.C. can't restrict that. But really, it was about Scalia for Donald Trump. He said that over and over. A strict constructionist is what he was fond of being called, and Donald Trump said that's what he was going for.
Although, even though our listeners has, as the question, did you have a litmus test for your Supreme Court nominee? When he was asked that during the campaign, Trump said, no, he did not have a litmus test, even though those factors that you talked about are very important.
He may have said that he didn't have one. They tend to bind the hands of senators when they're evaluating nominees, but it's pretty clear he had a couple of his own tests, if you don't want to call them litmus, that he did go by.
Yeah, yeah. In addition to undocumented immigrants, are you prioritizing, Mr. President, deportation of lawful U.S. residents? So what's the administration thus far indicated about how they're going to deport people, if there's a priority list, a set of you go first?
Right. So this is a question right now as the rollout of the travel ban still swirls. Administration officials were in the Senate briefing members last night. These questions are happening as we speak as they try to figure it out. Incredulous senators asking about the travel ban. There were cases where green card holders, of course, were turned away or asked to surrender those green cards in the first days of this rollout of the travel ban. The administration now says that green cards will be deemed as dispositive that a traveler is not a threat, meaning if you have a green card, they would let you in if you've already been vetted for that green card. Federal judges overruled over the weekend, as you know, they ruled that those already arrived holding valid visas or those in transit can enter. That's going to be a court fight. But in the future, John, I want to point you to some draft proposed rule changes that have been circulating around Washington. And these are not executive orders, but rules changes. So they would take a little bit longer to work their way through the system, where the Trump administration is looking to change the rules on what kinds of legal immigrant workers would be able to enter the United States and under what circumstances they would be able to work certain jobs, like, for instance, seasonal farm workers. That's one example. Seasonal construction workers. The administration appears to be looking at tightening those rules so that fewer legal immigrants could come in, and presumably for legal working immigrants that are already here, tightening up on them, more of them would have to leave. Those are draft rules that are circulating right now, and many of these questions are unanswered.
Which could bear on deportation. What do you do to alleviate student loan debt? That was a question asked. I'll give you that one as a last final.
Yeah, and Donald Trump actually has a plan here. Look, this is going to have to be figured out by Congress, but Donald Trump has a plan here that would raise the cap on low-income student loans. They pay, they're capped at 10% of income now. That would go up to 12.5%, but you would get out from under debt sooner because you pay more under the Trump plan. Congress is going to have to figure that out.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much. 100 days, 100 Qs, remember that. The Boy Scouts of America has announced it would welcome transgender children who identify as boys from now on. The Monday announcement settles a lawsuit by the Maldonado family, whose transgender son Joe had been excluded.
I felt sad and angry at the same time. I just felt like the first time it happened, I felt like this. And then later on, I kind of just got really angry at them.
The Scouts as an organization have seen huge declines in membership since insisting on excluding gays as Scouts or leaders until 2013, when all that changed. Scott Leadingham, journalist and editor at Quill magazine at the Society for Professional Journalists and longtime Eagle Scout, who is also gay, is now hopeful that scouting can recover its place as a unifying activity for American young people in this century. But right now, there's a transition going on.
They are struggling with what every other organization is struggling with, which is declining membership, lots of other things that kids and families want to do. And if you look at the announcement that was made just the other day by the chief scout executive, he acknowledged that we need to modernize. We need to make sure that families and kids are attracted to the Boy Scout program. And that's basically what they're doing. They're acknowledging that they can't go forward just having the same sorts of membership, the same sorts of organizations, which is a lot of churches, driving the membership. They need to be open to everyone who wants to be in the scouting program. And that's exactly what's happening here.
What do you think the overriding and overarching need was to permit transgender individuals to be in scouting?
Well, yeah, we'd like to think that these lofty ideals are driving it, you know, that a scout is not only trustworthy and loyal and all the other points of the scout law, that a scout is also maybe egalitarian. And yes, let's hope that that is absolutely behind it. But in reality, there's a lot of financial pressures on the Boy Scouts and every other organization, and the foundations and businesses that fund it in large part, they were pushing for it. They have to be pushing for it because the people on those corporate boards are demanding it. You know, the current president of the Boy Scouts is the CEO of AT&T, and he can't lead his company at AT&T while also continuing to lead the Boy Scouts as president and have a policy that is not equitable.
Do you think there's a worry that the scouting organization has got so tangled up in this that it's now sort of branded with this either intolerant kind of reputation or just, oh, they're all messed up in that whole gays and transgender thing, let's do something different than scouting kind of idea, and that parents and families are just kind of steering clear of the controversy, like they would steer clear of a traffic accident or something?
I think it's still, though, an organization that parents and families look to as not just something to, you know, fill time for their kids, but an organization that's going to instill in them values that are important to families, these values of trustworthiness and outdoor leadership. And to the extent that the Scouts understand that they need to make those values attractive to all families, not just certain families because you happen to be Mormon or Catholic or some other religious organization, that's what's going on here. They want to make sure that all families are attracted to the scouting program. The scouting program, as I experienced it and I've seen other people experience it, is the program that really instills in youth the kinds of values that we want in American citizens. Yes, it talks about citizenship, but it also talks about, you know, physical fitness and appreciation for the outdoors, stewardship for the outdoors, all these qualities that we hope that you're learning in school. But if you're not necessarily learning it to the extent you should learn it, this can supplement that program. And that's exactly what the Boy Scouts have done, and they've always done. The core values of the Boy Scouts have never changed, and I don't think they need to change, but those values need to be open and accessible to all people in the United States.
When I was in a scout troop, I recall distinctly that the scouts themselves are so non-judgmental that, I mean, they may be teenagers that, you know, are exploring new things, including sexuality, et cetera, but that kids don't care about these kinds of things that, you know, become lawsuits, that adults get involved. Do you see that is the case in your coverage of scouting, that young people are just beyond some of these controversies that certain adults get all hung up about?
Yeah, I've long joked with friends in the program that, you know, Boy Scouts would be way better if no adults were involved. And I say that, you know, somewhat jokingly, but also because, yeah, just as what you're saying, yeah, kids will be kids. There's going to be, you know, unfortunate bullying perhaps, and from time to time. And yes, that happens just as it happens in schools. But really the people that get hung up about these sorts of controversies, you know, the people reacting to the transgender membership policy and previously to the gay youth and adult policy are, you know, church leaders and other people who don't like it because they have some sort of value system that they think is going to be disrupted. And kids just want to be kids. They don't give a crap who is coming into the troop. They just want to have some fun out in the woods.
Did you encounter intolerance as a young gay man in the Scouts?
Well, I should be clear that I didn't come out until later in the program, until I was after I was an adult in the program. And that's for, you know, many social reasons probably as well. But I don't think I would have, honestly, just looking back on it, I don't think I would have encountered that resistance from my fellow Scouts, possibly again from some adults or others in my circles. But I have to say, maybe I was just lucky in that regard, that I was in an environment that was open and accepting, I think, to all people.
The importance of this a change by the scouts? Just to wrap it up, what do you think? Is this a milestone? Is all of this behind scouting now?
It's absolutely important. Is it going to bring in, you know, millions of new members? No, I doubt it, of course. But it is important for the Boy Scouts to reflect what society can and should be. And society and the Boy Scouts should be an organization that wants to share its values with all people. It's very important, just maybe not so much in the numbers, but also definitely in the optics.
Scott Leadingham, journalist and editor at Quill Magazine at the Society of Professional Journalists and a longtime Eagle Scout. And boy, can you hear it. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, John.
Writer Paul Beatty is not someone whose thoughts you want to predict. His latest book, The Sellout, was published in 2015 and last year became the first novel by an American author to win the UK's Man Booker Prize. It is a brilliant, harrowing romp through the ways in which we are imprisoned in America by our history and language, and in some ways by this very American belief that, hey, we're doing the best we can given our history, folks. Beatty says progress can be a very dangerous drug in America, and he's not a user. Doesn't mean he's negative about everything, but when you talk to him, he's always affectionately deriding himself for going negative. There I go again, he says. I just wanted to talk with him today about all that is swirling around in America right now. It was a good decision, I think. I hope you'll agree.
There's a poet, he's kind of recently passed away, a guy named Amiri Baraka, a smart guy.
Yeah.
And I went to see him read once, and I told 9 million stories about this one reading. But anyways, one of the things he was talking about, you know, in terms of perception, was he's talking about Stephen Fetchett, the quintessential black Hollywood coon, you know. He was talking about Stephen Fetchett, and he's like, you know, you see him in the movies, you know, and his white boss is, you know, whoever's employing him, will go tell Stephen Fetchett, pick up that bucket 40 feet away. Stephen Fetchett would, you know, take 40 minutes to move 40 feet, slow, mumbling, ambling, you know. And Baraka pointed out this thing where he goes, you know, only the most servile person, only the real true sellout is going to run to pick up the bucket. You know, he goes, there's a reason why Stephen Fetchett is taking his time. You know, it's his own kind of way, his own method of subversion. I thought that was so smart and so insightful.
Seeing the defiance in something that's so ostensibly offensive.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And ostensibly servile.
Yeah.
You know, and that always really stuck with me. I thought that was just, you know, but that's just one case of many of these things. You know, and I kind of do it with, you know, things that I do in my own life. I'm not that succinct of a storyteller, so I appreciated that. But, you know, that's like kind of an example of what I'm trying to do a little bit.
A very educated, wonderful person, friend of the show and mine, on the day after the election, said that the election of Trump was a white supremacist result. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, white supremacy is everywhere. It's always has been, you know, might not always will be. I'm not one of those people who thinks that it's just this de facto way that the world is. But for me, the thing I've been, you know, I'm not supposed to talk about this. My wife wants me to write about this. But I think for me, a thing that I haven't worked out that I've been thinking about, it's weird. It's like it's like an example of white self-hatred, which doesn't really get talked about. And in the way that I can relate to self-hatred is this thing about you often do things as a manifestation of that that's often against your own interest. Voting, who you choose as a mate, all these kind of things. How you want to see yourself, how you want other people to see you. You know, this is another weird example. I was really young. I can't remember when this happened, but you remember David Duke running for governor of Louisiana?
Yeah, yeah.
So I was in L.A. I don't know how old I was, but 15, 16, I guess. I don't know. I was at the Keaton's house. We were in their apartment watching the news, and they put the results up. He got, I don't know, 30% of the white vote, you know, this and that. And at the bottom of the screen, David Duke had got like 6% of the black vote. And I remember my friend Ronald Keaton running up to the television and tapping on the glass going, who are these stupid, you know, are they? And I was like, yeah, who are they? And for me, that's this self-hatred thing. That's like a small example of this writ large in terms of not just race, gender, a lot of things. Self-hating capitalists, I don't know what it is, but it's this weird thing that I haven't really worked out yet. But that's how it registers to me in a weird way. And the other thing is, I mean, the interesting thing for me is how I haven't heard much of it now, you know, post the inauguration, but how he kind of – and people didn't mind that he didn't run away from this really staunch white racist support, which is nuts to me. Just on an individual level, how do you not question yourself about why these people are in favor of me? You know, not that he has to change anything, but just – and it was weird. The interesting thing for me, it's not like I paid a ton of attention to this, but I never saw anyone who knew how to even broach the subject, which I thought was really interesting.
No, I mean it was either you disavow them or you can't play. And he just said, no, wrong. I don't have to do anything. They're supporting me. I don't care.
Yeah, he didn't have to do anything because there was no – you know, we've – you know, this is a nation that hasn't had to be accountable for a lot ever, but is really just blatantly unaccountable for many things, you know, starting with, you know, these wars in the Middle East, Wall Street crisis. You know, and Trump's kind of running this thing of, hey – you know, and it reads as like this real – just unmitigated power in a weird way.
Why didn't things change more during the 8 years of Obama, do you think?
I don't think those things changed much. But, you know, things like same-sex marriage, there were some big changes made, you know. So it's not like things didn't change, you know. So, I'm not sure what his job is. I think that's another interesting thing that's happening now is what's this job of the president? Position versus the person? I'm old, I'm jaded, you know, but, you know, maybe that presidency, maybe this is something that has a ripple effect. You know, if, you know, I think about my students, mid-20s, you know, have spent a good portion of their lives with a black president. You know, maybe that has some effect. I don't know.
I just think we have the capacity to be better friends in this country, you know? It, for all the violence and horror and terrible history that we've all had, whatever groups we're talking about, we have a better capacity than we think to get along well.
So, I mean, so like, you know, I flew in. I just came in, you know, the other day and I got out of the airport, you know, international arrival, come through the customs, and there's a team of maybe 10 lawyers out there asking us, me and my wife, you know, did you see anyone who was detained? Did you see anyone, you know, these genuine concern, you know, I was like, oh, I'm great. This is a good thing, you know, and it's whether that team of lawyers over time, does that shrink from 10 to 2, 10 to 1? Does it grow from 10 to 15, 10 to 20? You know, there's a lot of stamina involved in all this, you know, so I'm always thankful for those people who have the stamina to continue having, you know, just as from what you're talking about, these conversations, to continue to be open, to continue to fight and be energetic. It's a rare quality. And so I'm thankful for those people.
Paul Beatty, thanks so much.
John, thank you for having me, man.
Paul Beatty is Man Booker Prize Award winner and author of The Sellout. He's participating in a New York City program called One Book, One New York, a citywide book club initiative that will bring New Yorkers together to read the same book at the same time. The mayor's office is unveiling it today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.